Blog Talk Radio.
And
proper reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silenced. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. So this morning I speak to you on this issue because I'm determined to take the gospel seriously. There is at the outset a very obvious an almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. And you may not know it, my friends, but it is estimated that we spend $500,000 to kill each enemy soldier, while we spend only $53 for each person classified as poor. And much of that $53 goes for salaries to people who are not poor. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportion relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schoolroom. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village But we realized that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago or Atlanta. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. America and most of its newspapers applauded me in Montgomery. I stood before thousands of Negroes getting ready to riot when my home was bombed and said, we can't do it this way. They applauded us in the sit-in movement. We nonviolently decided to sit in at lunch counters. They applauded us on the freedom rides when we accepted blows without retaliation. Oh, the press was so noble in its applause and so noble in its praise when I was saying, be nonviolent toward Bull Connor. There's something strangely inconsistent about a nation and a press that will praise you when you say, be nonviolent toward Jim Clark, but will curse and damn you when you say, be nonviolent toward little brown Vietnamese children. There's something wrong with that press. Another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. I cannot forget that the Nobel Peace Prize was not just something taking place, but it was a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances, but even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. Could it be that they do not know that the good news was meant for all men, for communists and capitalists, for their children and ours, for black and white, for revolutionary and conservative? Have they forgotten that my ministry is in obedience to the one who loved his enemies so fully that he died for them? What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister to Jesus Christ? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I not share with them my life? There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry. And who are we supporting in Vietnam today? It's a man by the name of General Key, who fought with the French against his own people, and who said on one occasion that the greatest hero of his life is Hitler. This is who we are supporting in Vietnam today. Oh, our government and the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told. And all the while the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform, now they languish under our bombs and consider us, not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They see the children degraded by our soldiers as they beg for food. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. This is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolutions impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that comes from the immense profits of overseas investment. Now, I'm convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin to shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our present policies. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. It will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes and with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. The genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole, in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This calls for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation. Is in reality a call for all embracing unconditional love for all men. This oft misunderstood and misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against this war, not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away. And this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today. Take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means losing a job, means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7-8-year-old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? I've long since learned that be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. This faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together. And every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will lead up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last with this faith. We'll sing it as we're getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations, neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you, I ain't gonna study war no more.
All right, and that was Martin Luther King. And
that was his speech actually on this day, or?
No, that was on his, this was 1967 actually. But the reason I brought this up, the reason I wanted to play it, was because it was the, this is the Obama, the great black president, okay?
Oh, he'd been terrific.
You know, has stated that he was going to attack Syria, and, you know, on the 30th, and that, you know, the frightening part about this all is that
He's thinking, he goes and speaks at a rally honoring Martin Luther King, who would be disgusted
would
with
be
this.
Would be totally disgusted by his
with the things that he's doing.
Yeah, everything that he's
surveillance,
doing.
Surveillance, thinking of attacking Syria,
going into different wars,
different wars.
Unconstitutional wars, and just going crazy, and then taking, you know, then you know, taking Martin Luther King's name and promoting it, like, oh wow, he would be, I love this guy, he's so wonderful, all right, but yet he defiles the name of Martin Luther King, you know, and it's just disgusting. And Layla's got a thing she wants to read. Trump honors the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Washington. And Larry Dorman, who's with us tonight, will be coming up shortly.
Well, this is by Kenneth Quinnell, and it's from the AFL-CIO Now. AFL-CIO President Richard Trump issued the following statement on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. 50 years ago, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., AFL-CIO Vice President A. Phillips Randolph, labor and civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, and UAW President Walter Reuther and countless Americans marched for equality, jobs, and freedom. This march became a pinnacle of the civil rights movement, symbolizing hope and power of the nation and of united action. Today, on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the fight for equality and justice for all continues. The Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act. Extremists in the U.S. House of Representatives are stalling reform of our broken immigration system. Women make 77 cents to a man's dollar, and workers' rights are in jeopardy across the nation. But today, the unforgettable sounds and images from 1963 also remind us that change is possible.
I'm calling Larry right now.
Oh. And he said, today we rededicate ourselves to the quality that so many marched for a half a century ago. Strive for prosperity for all in this great nation. Ethnicity, gender.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
And here's Larry.
Good, Lila. Good. How you doing? Hi, Lila.
Oh, I'm well. Did you have a good summer?
Ah, fantastic. Too bad it's over.
Yep.
Yeah, too bad.
Yeah, back to work and back to thinking about things and what's going on. And
yep.
we're coming up toward Labor Day weekend, which is a big day for the union. And, of course, we're remembering the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And in that regard, Leo just played a speech by Martin Luther King, which was very interesting, an excellent speech.
It was actually a speech on war crimes, and the truth must be told about, you know, anti-war and how
right.
outraged she was by the Vietnam War.
Yep.
Yeah, and something that we all need to remember in remembering Martin Luther King, we have to remember that he was a peace activist.
Yeah.
And
yes,
he not supported black people, he supported poor people of all colors all around the world.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We had a forum, we just finished up a town hall forum in Hartford, and unfortunately I can't stay on for the full time because we've got a lot of cleanup to do, actually, but we literally just finished the event, and fabulous event. I took my daughter, who's 25, and she was mesmerized. We had a terrific panel and different perspectives about Dr. King and the legacy of the march and the challenges that face us today. And you know, you're right. And one of the things that was addressed was the, in this commemoration, is the fact that he was a labor rights activist. He was a peace anti-war activist. Obviously, he fought for civil rights. He really stood up for everything that was possible and good in this country. And you know, we've got to figure out how we honor that legacy.
Absolutely. And he also said that you can't stand on the fence.
Right.
You need to speak up. He said
silence. Silence was a crime. You know,
he did say that. I love that saying of his. One of the speakers actually tonight at our town, at this forum we had at Shiloh Baptist Church in Hartford, a woman from the voter rights attorney, Joan Gibson, said to the crowd, you know, this is on us. We can't complain. People fought, bled and die for the right to vote, and if we just sit back and stay quiet about it, it'll continue. So you know, we can complain about the people in power who are abusing us, or we can step up and stand up and do something. That's a good message,
and I think that's absolutely true. We do need to stand up and do something.
Yeah, that's why I applaud you guys. I know that we don't always agree on positions, and I know we'll probably have our differences about the Obama administration, but you guys are out there speaking your mind and trying to make the country better, and I think I wish more people would do what you're doing.
Yeah, we're just trying to bring some truth and some balance to the debate,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And which is not happening.
And I think it's
not.
That functions like the one that you attended, because the mainstream media does not address those particular parts of Martin Luther's speeches and his background and what he believed in.
I hate to jump in. Our union helped organize this event tonight. One of my coworkers put it together, and you know, to one degree, I failed in my job because only Channel 30 showed up. So, you know, the media, the mainstream media doesn't really, you know, seem to care about this stuff.
No, they're not interested.
They want to take Martin Luther King and remake him to fit what they want people to think and believe.
Yeah, it was just like how Obama kind of took Martin Luther King's birthday this year and became Obama birthday. You know what I mean? He blew it all out of proportion, and that's what he's doing today.
I'm a little troubled. I have to replay his brief speech at the ceremony in Washington today, but I could be wrong on this, so I'm going to have to apologize if I am. But I believe he failed to mention the word union in his remarks, and you know that's. For anybody, you know, everybody, including the pastor at the church here, said, you know, the unions are, for all their faults and failings, you know, I'm a union member, and the unions embraced Dr. King and worked together with him. He died trying to help workers organize. So anybody who wants to discuss and honor the King legacy and fails to mention unions is really either, you know, willfully missing something or, you know, playing to
a I agree with you 100%.
I agree with you 100% too, because he represented poor people of all colors and working people of all colors around the world.
That's right.
He saw
exactly
this
right.
global problem,
and
not just the United States problem.
And he said
the man with a great vision.
It wasn't a racist issue. It wasn't a. He never. He said it wasn't a black and white issue. It was a rich and
right.
poor issue. And he
exactly.
And that was his bottom line, you know. And
can you imagine what he would have to say today about the too big to fail banks
and
the bailout and the fact that the Wall Street
guys
got off scot free? He would.
Yeah,
he,
you
he
know,
would.
Cornel
he,
West.
He,
I saw a remarkable interview with
yeah.
Cornel West. I think I mentioned this to you last month when we spoke. I don't know. But he said that he and Martin Luther King would not be invited to this rally, okay, today. All right? He wasn't actually invited. And Martin Luther King would not attend because he says
yeah.
everything was so vehemently opposed to what Obama stands for, okay, and what
mm-hmm.
Clinton stands for and what Carter stand for and what everybody who attended there. You know, they forgot the basic issue of what that whole march was about, which was equal rights. this nightmare that we were going through in the '60s, and we're still going through now, right? And Obama
yeah,
just declared war on Syria, for crying out loud. I mean,
practically, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And you know, and before you know, that's on everybody's mind, and you know, it's funny because you know, you have Clinton up there today, and this is the guy who worked with the Republicans to bring us NAFTA and help
yeah.
destroy middle-class jobs. It was his administration that actually, much as you want to blame the Republicans for everything that happened with the financial meltdown in the 2000s and 2008, you know, the Clinton administration and Chris Dodd and these guys, they were the ones who repealed Glass-Steagall. You know, that broke down the investment and banking wall. So, you know, these guys have all been complicit in the destruction of the middle class that's going on. And I think Dr. King would be horrified.
Oh, I think he would be, too. And I love Cornel West's statement. I'm not serving on the Obama plantation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he said. You know, and
you can't
get any more straight than that.
You know, and he said Obama was just a complete fraud, you know, and a failure to the black people.
And certainly to
yeah.
black
people. Well, I'm not going to, I always want to be careful with that. I mean, I was at a church in the north end of Hartford where I think a lot of the parishioners would disagree with that. They're very proud, as they should be, of Obama. I just think the problem is the system. You know, and both parties have kind of capitulated to the system.
But you know,
so the lobbyists and the bankers kind of, you know, they own, and the insurance companies and, you know, the corporate powerhouses, they're the ones, you know, they own Congress. That's, you know, that's just, I'm not necessarily letting the president off the hook because he's not performed as capably as we'd all hope, but. The system is geared toward the plutocrats, and that's the problem.
All he's really proved is that it really doesn't matter what color you are, you can still be swayed by very wealthy interests in this country.
That's
unfortunately. I mean, he's no different than Clinton or Bush. Or
right.
A few blacks have done a lot better under him, that's true, but not the majority of black people or minority people.
Right.
We
greatly. We got to get back to the, you know, the speakers, to a person, the group of the speakers tonight. They're voting right activists, labor activists, an attorney, a professor. And, you know, to a person, everybody's point was that we have got to we've gotten some good things done, but we've got to get back to the core message about empowering people to live better lives through dignity, respect, and economic empowerment, you know, and that's what we need to see happen, and that's what's not happening.
I think it's wonderful that you took your daughter, who's 25. That's great. Were there a lot of people there?
What do you think, about 100 people there? I'm asking her right now. 100 people? Yeah, 100 people. But, you know, she asked them, obviously she's my daughter and I'm proud of her. She asked a question about, you know, young people and what's taught in the schools about about economic opportunity and labor inequities. But, you know, there weren't a lot of young people in the audience. And that was one of the questions was, you know, you had a bunch of 40, 50, 60-year-old people say, you know, what we really need to be doing is getting the message down to the schools and drilling down to the kids so that they're,
Which isn't getting there. Yeah.
And, I mean, this is the kind of day that should be talked about in schools.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that's why, again, I think that what you guys do is valuable because, let's face it, the technology, kids are generally younger people. I don't want to be overly general, but, you know, younger people blog. They're online. They're texting. You know, that's how we have to reach. That's how you got to reach people through the latest technology, not through the traditional means. You know, if we rely on the, like you guys know, if you rely on the traditional media, you're not going to get anywhere.
Oh, absolutely. We
have been so amazed at the response to our programs over the last year or 2 years. We've seen. Well, we've been on since 06, actually, on the internet. And it took quite
been
a while.
That long?
We've been actually on radio, for instance, 2003, television and radio since 1999. But the amazing thing is that we've seen, we never had a chance to really have an international audience. And our program is now listened to by 147 countries, for crying out loud.
Isn't that amazing, what technology has done?
It's overwhelming. We can see this on our stats, you know, and stuff, and see where the things come from. And the union issue in the United States, everywhere, you know? It's critical everywhere.
Yeah. I hate to do this. I am going to lose you because of where I am in my car.
Oh, Larry, I just wanted to mention to you, we announced it, I believe we announced it last night on the show, but did you know that the minimum wage in Australia is $16.95?
Am I not surprised?
The minimum wage in the United States is $7.25, and almost every other industrialized country is higher than ours. Isn't that amazing?
So we have a lot to work on, but you said you might lose us, so we thank you very much for being on at this moment.
We'll talk very soon.
All right, Larry.
Thanks, Leah. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Great that the union organized that.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I hope
they filmed it and they could put it on, you know, the internet.
They should have it on Access.
They have it on their site.
Yeah, who knows?
I should have asked him that. That was a failure on my part to mention that.
But anyway, that was Larry Dorman from the ASME Union, and we're very proud to have him on every once a month, and talk to him. And they sponsored the Martin Luther King rally back in, I guess, in the Baptist Church.
And the unions were a big part of that initial rally 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And to not mention the unions, I hope Obama mentioned them.
No, Obama is such a hypocritical, sociopathic moron that, you know, we can't support him, and I'm sorry. You know, we are union supporters, but he hasn't really done that much to support us. I'm sorry, Obama's a sociopath. He wants to go to war again.
I just can't accept that.
We can't accept what he's doing and under any circumstances. Obamacare is a failure, a complete failure. They don't even talk about it anymore. I don't think they're going to be enacting it. Congress has pushed it off, and Obama has, because companies have stated that if they have to implement Obamacare, they're going to have to lay off.
They must be implementing it because your niece is training people.
She's only implementing it in the sense that not to the company so much as to the government. The government doesn't even know what they're talking about.
I don't think anybody's really read the whole thing.
I have a niece who works for a corporation that specializes in Medicare and teaching people, informing agencies.
She's probably one of the few people that's read it.
She's probably one of the few people in the country who actually knows what's going on with Obamacare. But the funny thing about this is that, but the sad thing about it is that it's going to be so costly to everybody that.
And there was no need for it. We have a perfectly good single payer system. It's called Medicare.
Yeah, it would have worked.
Just use that
perfectly. If you just incorporated everything.
And you wouldn't have to redo anything. It's all done.
But this thing redesigned, and the crazy thing about it is nobody in Congress even read this policy.
Because
nobody
it was like thousands of pages.
Yeah, it was 2,000 pages, just overwhelming. And companies.
I would guess 2,000 pages of obfuscation.
That's pretty much what it is. And what it does is it gives the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies a total leeway to charge whatever the hell they want to charge and to make sure that everybody in the country, 300,000, 310, 17 million people get insured. I mean, it's incredibly insane. So, let us go to some good news tonight. Did you know that a full ripe banana with dark patches on yellow skin produces a substance called TNF, tumor necrosis factor, which has the ability to combat abnormal cells? The more darker patches it has, the higher will be its immunity enhancement quality. Hence, the riper the banana, the better the anti-cancer quality. Yellow skin banana with dark spots on it. Okay. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah, you don't like this guy, that ripe of banana.
No, I don't like that.
I do love them, and the more ripe they are, the better off they are for
fighting
cancer. So there you go, folks. Eat ripe bananas.
That's a bit of good news, Leo. What else is happening?
Well, that's interesting. Eliminate the parasites that you almost certainly have. This is frightening, but it's very real. But let's go beyond that. California begins confiscating legally purchased guns. Right? Yeah, it's starting, folks. Starting. Right? So this is from downtrend.com. And, you got to be careful. This is what's happening. It's not surprising that the first police raids take legally purchased firearms from citizens are in California. Until recently, the state had the strictest gun control laws, and the liberal-run state government has always looked unfavorably on the Second Amendment. Well, earlier this year, the state legislature expanded the list of what they called prohibited persons, people who have legally registered a firearm but for various reasons are no longer allowed their Second Amendment rights. These reasons were expanded to include people who are behind on their state taxes, did not pay toll fees in a timely manner, and a wide range of other minor misdemeanors or reported mental health concerns. In preparation for the crackdown, the state authorized $24 million to hire additional officers to track down 20,000 people on the list. Some persons on this list were, one person was Joe Mendez. A police officer came to the door and lured Mendez out of his house with a story of a hit-and-run report. Once outside, he had M16s pointed within inches of his face, was taken into custody, and had all weapons removed from his house. It is important to remember that these were legally purchased and registered firearms. That gets to the other issue about this initiative. The case demonstrates what registration lists really are. They are tools to allow police to confiscate weapons. And all they have to do in California is come up with a reason you should be on the prohibited persons list, a list that is continuously expanding and its scope and definition. California gun owners, beware. Your firearms and rights are being confiscated by your liberal politicians. Folks, this is happening. Can you imagine that? These bastards are coming to your door and telling you...
They didn't say why his, in particular, why his were confiscated.
Well, he didn't pay, he was on taxpayer, he didn't pay his taxes or something.
Well, they didn't say that. They said there were various reasons.
Various,
I wondered which reasons.
Know, whatever they are, you know. The guy bought them legally, registered them legally, and then they took them away from him. I don't know. That's bad news. That's really, really not right.
But the article really didn't tell you everything. You know,
okay,
left out.
I'm so sorry, but whatever happened, they stole his guns.
But I'd
don't
like
you
to
think so?
I'd like to know why, and they were careful. And it does matter. I'd like to know.
Yeah, M16 pointed at his face.
I'd like to know the other part of it, Leo.
There wasn't any other part.
Because they didn't write it. That's why. I want to know what the other piece was. It was an incomplete article.
No, it wasn't. There's enough to know.
No,
that
it was
incomplete. The guy got his gun.
That was your opinion. My opinion is it's incomplete.
All right. Well, since it's Labor Weekend, let me go to this article and get off the gun control issues, which
I'm
very upset about.
I can see that.
Tens of thousands of South African workers go on strike over pay.
I don't blame them. I wonder how much they paid.
Well,
on Monday, some 90,000 construction workers in the mining industry struck work to demand a 13% pay increase. On the same day, the Congress of South African Trade Unions issued a statement saying they cannot plead poverty and must share their super profits with workers who risk life and limb every day in one of the most dangerous working environments. Also on Monday, South African Transport and Allied Workers Union spokesman Vincent Masoga issued a statement saying 1,300 aircraft maintenance technicians went on strike to demand a 12% wage increase. South Africa's mining sector has been paralyzed by a series of wildcat strikes over miners' low wages since August 2012. Dozens of people so far have been killed in the strike-related violence. In February 2013, South African security guards shot dead mine workers outside Armplaats. I can't pronounce the name.
Sipumele
Mine in the
city of Rustenburg.
Following a clash between rival union factions. In June, South African President Jacob Zuma called for dialogue among all stakeholders in the mine sector, saying all stakeholders, government, management in the mining sector, trade union movement in particular, should talk and find a way to deal with this matter. The South African president went on to say that the stakeholders have the capacity to discuss and agree about the problems, including strikes and deadly clashes faced by the mining industry. They didn't really say how much these workers are paid. Probably not very much.
But they wanted was a 13% increase. So
those mine workers made billions of dollars off people at the top make billions of dollars.
The mine company.
The workers don't make very much. And terrible. I remember we read one article a few years back where there was a clash with mine workers and the company just plowed them under.
They plowed them under. That was, what was that company? It was owned by Bush, Bush Sr.
Yeah.
Gold company.
I've forgotten which.
Barrick Gold, I think it was.
Yeah.
Barrick Gold.
Yeah. They were miners.
Yeah, they were a mining company.
Yeah, I've forgotten which country that was in.
Yeah, you got to love this. I love this. Will media remember that Hillary Clinton is touting the Syrian ruler as a reformer? Yeah. Hillary Clinton is one of the biggest hoaxes the universe has ever seen. Right? But, that's... And people want to run her as president.
Oh, God, help us.
God forbid. Hey, God, just help us all. Hillary Clinton.
The Republicans are going to come up with.
Oh, they'll come up with some horrible Ruiz or Brias or some
Marco
other,
Rubio.
Or some other clown, right? And, you won't have any vote.
Christie from New Jersey.
Christie. Yeah, the Rotundra vote, you know. So, yeah, we really got a choice next year. It'll be amazing. But, you know, Obama is such a crazy son of a bee. This guy may put us into World War III within the next few days. Yeah, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to end this, I don't know if you want to end this in health or you want to end this in real world, but let's just look at this for 1 second because I think it's so really important. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, you're crazy. You got to listen to MSNBC, all right? But, hey, the former French foreign minister, Ronald Dumas, admits the war on Syria was planned 2 years before the Arab Spring. Dumas states in a TV interview that top British officials confessed that they were preparing a war on Syria and asked if I wanted to participate. And the former French Minister of Foreign Affairs appeared in a TV interview with a French TV channel. He says, I'm going to tell you something. I was in England 2 years before the violence in Syria on other business. I met with top British officials who confessed to me that they were preparing something in Syria. Well, Dumas continued, indicating that the subversion and invasion of the Syrian Arab Republic and the help of the Arab rebels was primarily a British plan. Well, he carefully avoided implicating himself in the French, saying, this was a Britain, not in America. Britain was organizing an invasion of rebels in Syria. They even asked me, although I was no longer Minister of Foreign Affairs, if I would like to participate. Naturally, I refused. I said, I am French. That does not interest me.
Dumas continued the interview, pointing to the role of Israel in the Middle East and Israel's role with regard to Western Middle East foreign policy and the war on Syria. The war has so far cost an estimated 93,000 lives and has displaced more than 2 million since the onset of the Western subversion attempt in 2011. The majority of those who were killed were Syrian civilians murdered by Western-backed insurgents and terrorists. Dumas also indicated that nothing has changed since the Sikhs peacocked European colonialism in the Middle East and implicitly argues for the legitimacy of European colonialism in warfare on behalf of the Zionist state of Israel. What annoys Dumas is apparently not neo-colonialism and violations of international law, but the fact that Western powers are not open and honest about it, Dumas said. This operation goes way back. It was prepared, preconceived, and planned. In the region, it is important to know that this Syrian regime has a very anti-Israeli stance. Consequently, everything that moves in the region, and I have this from a former Israeli prime minister who told me, we will try to get on with our neighbors, but those who don't agree with us will be destroyed. It is a type of politics, a view of history. Why not after all? But one should know about it. With his statements, Dumas aligns himself legally and politically with Henry Kissinger, who doubts whether the provisions of international law on national sovereignty and non-interference into domestic affairs of sovereign nations enshrined in the Treaty of Westphalia and the Charter of the UN apply to former colonies whose borders have been arbitrarily drawn by former colonial powers. Although Dumas was very careful to avoid implicating France or himself directly in the planning stages of the subversion, his statement reveals that British officials have been vetting and contacting leading French policymakers for their potential involvement in planning the illegal war on Syria at least for 2 years before the onset of the first incident, which sparked mass protests. International analysts as well as Syrian sources have since 2011 maintained that the eruption of violence was systematically created from abroad. Whether Dumas will ever have to testify before an international war crimes tribunal under oath and risk of perjury to tell a judge who exactly the top British officials were who attempted to recruit Dumas, who allegedly rejected the offer of taking part, is doubtful as long as the International Criminal Court, the ICC at The Hague, remains in the sole option for the prosecution of war crimes.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
so,
good luck with that.
But at the same time,
France is supposedly going in with us.
Yeah. Well, France does not want to go into it. Their people do not want to go in there.
Oh, they have no say, just like we have no say.
Like we have no say. And it's sad. It's really, it's just criminally sad. And so before we go, we're leaving now. Time's up. I want to thank Larry Dorman from Astral Unions for joining us tonight. And that's about it.
And you'll be on tomorrow night?
Yeah, I'll be on tomorrow night.
So, folks,
we just have to remember what Martin Luther King really stood for and what's happening now in his name, which is a fraud. Fraud, a complete and utter total fraud.
And you have to remember that, and you have to say it.
Yeah.
Just be blunt.
You just have to say it. We have to bring that out. So, So thank you everybody for joining us tonight. Thank Astral Union for standing up for some issues and working to bring out some truth. And with all that, we wish you a pleasant evening.
Good night, folks. Have a good night.
Good night, everybody.